Revi of Miketz is a significant turning point because this represents the part where the brothers and Yosef reunite. But of course, as we know, it doesn't start with immediate recognition of each other. It starts very awkwardly and very dramatically with the brothers not recognizing Yosef and Yosef recognizing them. And we'll go through the psukim like we generally do, but just to make a couple of broad comments about this aliyah as a whole. So there is a lot to say and to comment about the nature of Yosef's behavior here. It's not immediately obvious what exactly are his motivations, and they seem a little manipulative. It seems like he's kind of toying with them. And whether it seems vengeful or it seems cruel or however you want to understand it, it's a little difficult to understand in the light of our assumption that Yosef is a tzaddik, and therefore one would expect that he would be completely forgiving and certainly that he wouldn't toy with that, essentially. So there is a lot written about this, and I'll quote a little bit of it, but just also as a mar makom. So I would recommend, especially Rabbi Rosenzweig Shlita, who we'll be hearing from on Monday, but Rabbi Rosenzweig has an article about this in the first volume of Mitoch Ohel. Mitoch Ohel on the Parshios and Parshios Miketz, Rabbi Rosenzweig focuses on this issue specifically. Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch as well, in his comments to this aliyah, talks about this also. Both of them deal with this question at length. What exactly was Yosef doing? And essentially, they say things in different ways, but there's a lot of overlap. Rabbi Tal Rudinsky, who we'll mention as well, talks about this a little bit in his Sefer Mishkan Betzalel, also on these psukim. Even though the behavior that we're about to comment on goes from this aliyah all the way through Vayigash, so it's not just about this aliyah, but it happens to be that Rav Hirsch's comments and Mishkan Betzalel are both focusing on the beginning of the interaction you find in this aliyah specifically. So the understanding is that even though we certainly do assume that Yosef, as a tzaddik, would be a forgiving personality, but to forgive doesn't just simply mean to ignore. It doesn't simply mean to say that nothing happened here and there's nothing to talk about, and that there needed to be a genuine process of repentance and a genuine process of the brothers recognizing that things have changed and Yosef being able to see that things have changed. It happens to be a discussion in the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Bachya and others, Rashi has a tshuva about just how clear is it from the text towards the end of Sefer Bereishis that Yosef actually does forgive his brothers. But working off the assumption that Yosef did indeed forgive his brothers, so the forgiveness was not a facile, immediate, yeah, it's no problem, don't worry about it. But there had to be a process by which they could both prove growth and change, and he could see it. So Rav Hirsch, for example, emphasizes the fact that Yosef needed to see that the brothers could have such a shift in attitude that now they do care about the depriving of a father of his beloved son. So the same way they were willing to send Yosef away, or to kill Yosef theoretically, and sold him into slavery, and to deprive Yaakov of Yosef, now if they are genuinely more concerned that the same thing shouldn't happen with Binyamin, in a sense that itself is an expression of tshuva, and that was something he kind of needed to bring out. In that sense, he doesn't make this comment, but there is a famous medrash in the beginning of Vayigash, in the next week's parsha, where when Yosef reveals himself to the brothers and he says, "Ani Yosef, Ha'od Avichai," and the Medrash has a comment over there that this is a tremendous statement of Musar. Wow, it's incredibly powerful what kind of Musar was going on over there. So the Beis Halevi is one of many who comment in fascinating ways in many great words on that Medrash. But the Beis Halevi is one of many who comments on that the Musar they were getting is that here Yehuda is giving this whole speech about how he has such rachmanis on his father can't be taken away from Binyamin, he can't have Binyamin taken away from him, he'll die, and to that Yosef essentially points out his inconsistency, or his hypocrisy, however you want to assess it, and he says, really, you're so worried about your father dying because he's going to miss his child? Ani Yosef, Ha'or Avichai, I'm the Yosef who you took away from Yaakov all these years ago. Did he survive that? So on the one hand, that seems to be a statement of Mussar, but we could also take the whole thing a little more positively and saying that the discrepancy between the attitude towards Binyamin and the attitude towards Yosef represents maturity on the part of the brothers. That now they're not willing to put Yaakov through that, but previously they had put Yaakov through that. And maybe this whole exercise here is a way to display that they have grown the way that they have done tshuva. One of the points that Rav Rosenzweig discusses in his article, and we'll comment a little bit more about this as well, is that there is kind of a dual structure here, that on the one hand, Yosef is exposing the brothers to just what they did wrong exactly, is forcing them to remember and to essentially confront what they had done wrong without saying it outright, because since he is not acknowledging at the beginning that he's Yosef, and he's essentially running them through this obstacle course where they have to come on their own to a realization of what they have done. So therefore, it's on the one hand a substantive process of tshuva, but also he's not humiliating them directly, so perhaps it represents a certain careful balance as far as that is concerned. There's a lot more to say about this. Maybe we'll comment more, but for further reading and for your Shabbos reading perhaps this week, I would recommend, if you want a more detailed discussion of exactly what's going on here and how to view it as a more complex, nuanced process of tshuva and reconciliation, so I would highly recommend reading both Rav Shamshon Afal Hirsch's comments on the Aliyah, which are shorter, and also Rav Rosenzweig's article in Mitoch Ohel, which is not incredibly long, it's a few pages, but it's a more detailed discussion of how exactly this process plays out and what exactly were the intentions of Yosef and how is it consistent with the tzidkus that we associate with him. Are you have a question?
I'm just curious to say, is he recommending that Talmud Musar should be done, like in an indirect way? Should
maybe. You know, that pasuk, which is, you know, the Vayigash pasuk, which isn't Revi of our parsha or Revi of that parsha, so I guess we can't talk about it by contractual restrictions. But there's many, many different interpretations. I mean, at least four or five very powerful insights into human nature that are suggested in interpretation of that medrash. So it's open to many different points of analysis. So maybe yes, maybe no. In general, whether focusing on that statement specifically or the whole process, that's one of the points that Rav Rosenzweig suggests, that you do have kind of that going on, that Yosef is making a point without yelling at them or humiliate them, but letting them go through this somewhat difficult process so that they should come on their own to recognize exactly what it is they had done and how that needs to change. Or maybe how it has changed. So with that introduction, so let's look a little bit at the psukim. So the psukim tell us, v'tichlena shavishneha sava asher haya beretz mitzrayim. So they had the 7 good years, but those were over. And then it continues, v'tichlena shavishneha rav lavo. So now the 7 years of famine began. Kasher amar Yosef, just like Yosef had said, v'hirav b'chol haratzos v'chol eretz mitzrayim hayolachem. So in the whole world, there was famine, and only in Eretz Mitzrayim was there food. So Tirav kol Eretz Mitzrayim, but now they're starting to get hungry. Vayitzak ha'am el paro lalachem, so they ask paro for bread. Vayomer paro l'chol Mitzrayim l'chul Yosef asher yomar lachem tasu. So you go to Yosef, he's in charge of this, he's going to tell you what to do. The pasuk continues, v'harav haya al kol pnei ha'aretz, v'yiftach Yosef iskol asher bohem, so he's helping them out. Yosef is doling out the food, and the famine continues to increase. So now the famine is throughout the land, it's in the whole area, so all of these people are coming essentially to Yosef. So it's important to see here, as the Gemara Maseches Pesachim towards the end of Daf Kuf Yud Tesamid Aleph emphasizes, that essentially all the food that has been in the world is basically now under Yosef's distribution control. not just from Mitzrayim, but from everywhere else, because this becomes the place where the whole world is being sustained. And therefore, Yosef's leadership, and to consider just the hashgacha here, the idea that Yosef is in such a prominent position in Egypt, it's not just about Egypt, it's about the whole world. Essentially, he is a ruler of the world at this point. And this is a comment that Chazal have in a few places. They list individuals who were in positions of royalty over essentially the whole world, people like Ahasuerus and Lahavdil Kadosh Baruch Hu, who's the beginning and the end of the list. God is the beginning and the end. He is the ruler of the whole world. And in between, there have been human beings who have had such substantial royalties that they have been in charge of everything, and Yosef is in that company because of this role that he's playing now. So the pasuk continues. The next parak, pasuk aleph, Vayar Yaakov ki yesh shever b'mitzrayim, Vayomer Yaakov uvonov lama tisro. So there's a lot said about this pasuk. So here Yaakov sees that there is food in Mitzrayim. So what does it mean he sees? There was no TV yet for him to be watching. He couldn't see on the internet. What does it mean that he saw? Maybe he heard the report we get to him. So to say that he heard that there's food, what does it mean that he saw? So the Medrash suggests that this language of seeing is meant to suggest that there is some type of nevuah going on here, but his nevuah clearly has been compromised. He doesn't have enough Ruach HaKodesh to know what's going on with Yosef, but he has somewhat of a unclear kind of picture of the world. He's getting some kind of a Ruach HaKodesh, so he is getting this message in a incomplete way. Rav Soloveitchik in his drashas emphasized that he was able to perceive that what was happening in Egypt was clearly a very sensitive and wise distribution of the food, that this was a very enlightened economic policy that was worthy of the descendants of Avraham Avinu, and he was amazed trying to figure out how exactly could that happen. How is it that Avram's influence, his grandfather's influence, is being felt in such a pagan culture as Egypt? And that caught his attention. So he says to the brothers, Lama Tisro. So what does that mean? What do those words mean? And so it's not at all clear. Basically, why should you look at each other? Why should you be seen? Why should you look? So first to say, Al Pi Derech HaDrush, so the Gemara, Maseches Tainis, and if you don't obey, the Gemara says it means you shouldn't be seen. The Torah Tmimah has a little bit of a discussion on how exactly the word should be translated in that context. But it sounds like the Gemara is interpreting it as you shouldn't be seen, meaning that at this point, the brothers still had some food left over, so they had more food than others. So Yaakov was telling them, when you go down, and you still are a little bit full compared to everyone else, you're still taken care of more than other people around you, don't make that visible. You essentially should not show off your good fortune, because that will make people jealous. Rashi emphasizes the Bnei Esav and the Bnei Shmuel, which is a whole discussion that Ramban has about why he emphasizes that. That wasn't necessarily the population in Egypt, but the population along the way. But maybe it's, as the Mefarshim later suggests, that particularly when you talk about the descendants of Esav, there's a concern because Esav feels, and this is a theme that you find in anti-Semitism throughout the generations, that Esav feels especially like Yosef and Yaakov and Yosef have taken away his due in the world, have taken away his portion. So particularly there's a jealousy there, and if it looks too much like you're doing too well, then they're going to get jealous. And that's the same idea that we find in the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, that when Yaakov sends messages to Esav, essentially trying to say that he hasn't become very wealthy, that he hasn't really profited so much, he's trying to calm down the potential jealousy of Esav. He doesn't want him to feel like, okay, you're upset that I got the bracha, but l'maisa, it hasn't really made much of a difference. I'm not any wealthier than you are. So that's a part of the message that he's saying here also, with this focus on Bnei Esav and Bnei Yishmael. But this is an idea that we find throughout. There is a famous Kriyakar that Willig is very fond of quoting In the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, if you want to look it up, it's in Dvarim, Perek Beis, Pasuk Hey, commenting on Pnu Lachem Tzafona, that essentially one should go towards the inside rather than the outside with one's material success. That the idea that you make a lot of money and that you want to display that to the world, that's not good midos or good advice. It's not a good strategy. It creates jealousy, and that brings about problems. And very often we see that in Jewish society, this is the attitude to kind of display the success and the wealth. And the advice that we have from Yaakov Avinu throughout, and again, this particular comment to the Kli Yakar is very often quoted. The later Sfarim on this pasuk, many of them make reference to this Kli Yakar. It's also very worthwhile reading. That, I remember Yossi Rewillig always quotes this in the summer, and Marsha Kola would always quote this when it's Parshas Dvarim. So it's one of the major themes in terms of the Jew in exile. And Dvarim is always read right before Tisha B'Av. One of the major themes of the Jew in exile is they should be more aware of how they're being perceived and how they could potentially be causing jealousy. The theme of an Ayin Hara, what exactly Ayin Hara is about, a very kind of mystical concept sometimes, but the notion that we try not to advertise our good fortune, advertise the brachas that we have in this world. So there are different understandings of what Ayin Hara is about. Some understand it more supernaturally, some understand it more rationally. The most common rational approach, so to speak, is that once you're showing off your good fortune, so you're attracting the jealousy of others, and that tends to have bad consequences, whether they do things to deprive you of these good fortunes or whether spiritually it brings about problems, however you want to understand it. In general, to attract that kind of attention, even though there is a human tendency to want to attract that kind of attention, so we're taught that it's not a good idea. This is not really the appropriate mahalach. And if you have bracha in this world, so you should be grateful for it, and you should use it for positive purposes. You should use it to advance your avodas Hashem, but not to show off. It's not there to make the rest of the world jealous. That's not advisable on any level. So that's in terms of understanding Tisro in that sense. In the more literal sense of what does it mean, Lama Tisro, which sounds like it means why are you looking at each other? So the Mefarshim have comments along those lines as well. Some of them it sounds a little bit comical if you picture it. That, for example, the Oznayim LaTorah, Lutzkarav, he suggests that it means that here the brothers are getting nervous because they're being told that they're to go down to Egypt, and they know that Yosef was sold down in that direction, and that going there could bring them in confrontation with Yosef. They didn't expect him to be the king, but they saw that this could be a dangerous situation for them. So they're kind of looking at each other. You can imagine the picture here that Yaakov is saying, okay, boys, I want you to go down to Egypt, and they start shooting glances at each other. Uh-oh, can't go there, you know what's going to happen. So he's watching this happen. He's saying, Lama Tisro, why are you looking at each other? What's going on? I'm telling you, go down to Egypt. What's the big deal? Rav Soloveitchik very similarly commented that this reflects the fact that they were starting to mature and to have regrets for what they had done, and therefore this represents their increasing sense of guilt over what had happened. And that's why they're looking at each other. Rav Shamshon Afal Hirsch also focuses on the idea of looking at each other, and he understands it a little bit differently. He has a whole description there about how how Yosef had planned out things, which we'll comment more in a second. But the point was that they all had to go down in order for them to be able to bring back any significant amount of food. And therefore, Yaakov was saying that you're all looking at each other, thinking, oh, why don't you go, why don't you go? Each one is pointing to the other one. And he's saying, I'm not saying one of you should go, I'm saying all of you should go. So stop looking at each other and wondering which one's going to do it. I'm telling you, you all have to go. Okay, so the pasuk continues. Vayomer hinei shamati ki yeshever mitzrayim redu sham v'shivur lona misham v'nichya v'lo namos. So Yaakov says, I have heard that there is food in Mitzrayim. The word for food here is shever, which normally means to break, And here I think it refers to another's comment also that the language is evocative of the idea of breakfast, the idea of food breaks hunger, and especially in this context, that's how it's referred to. So go down there and break our fast, so to speak, get us some food, so we should live and we shouldn't die. Good advice. So the 10 sons, they went down in order to do this. So Binyamin, who was the brother of Yosef, he didn't send down because he said maybe something terrible will happen to him. First, on this pasuk also has an extensive linguistic discussion about what Yikra'enu Asom means. That the language of Yikra'enu comes from many related words with different spellings. With an ayin, it means to tear away. With a hey, it means to happen. And he talks about how they all come together, and that to be torn away from the path of history is what we're talking about here, a tragic event to tear you away from what you're normally connected to. In any event, if I remember correctly, I think Rav Yonasan Eibshitz has a comment on this pasuk, that it's interesting that, if I heard correctly, when I wasn't here, so you guys learned the Sugya and Ksubis about the kavod for an older brother. Right, so there is a whole discussion about that. It's interesting. Rav Yonasan Eibshitz has a comment here that it is a little funny that why is it that the one brother who gets to stay home is Binyamin, he's the youngest. So essentially the youngest brother is letting the 10 older brothers go and work on his behalf. So that's not really Sobachavadik. So why should it be that the youngest brother gets to stay home and all the oldest brothers have to do all the work? So he comments, Rav Eibshitz, I think he has two terutzim, if I remember correctly. One is that the brothers aren't being so respected here, but the father, Yaakov, wanted Binyamin to stay home. So presumably the father trumps 10 brothers. So even if 10 brothers would have wanted that Binyamin go instead of them, but Yaakov wants him to stay home, he wins. He probably discussed during that sugya that the Ramban's understanding of what, because an opportunity to chazer that topic a little bit, that the Ramban's understanding of Kibarach HaGadol is based on the idea that it's an extension of Kibarav, that presumably the father wants that the older siblings should be respected. So if that's the case, it's all up to him. So here he's saying that I want Binyamin to stay home, so that's my plan, so there isn't any other issue. But the Rav Yonasan Eibshitz also has a very creative suggestion here, that he suggests that the Ramban has his understanding of what Kibarach HaGadol is about, but the Rambam has a different understanding, and Rav Yonasan Eibshitz had another understanding, a third understanding, I don't know if you discussed that when you saw the sugya, that he understands that the idea of kavod for an older sibling, it's a very creative interpretation, is based on the fact that, just like we find by Moshe Rabbeinu showing Hakar Satov to the Nile, that we have a concept of Hakar Satov, that you show acknowledgement of that which you have benefited from, even if it wasn't with full free will. So Moshe is grateful to the river for saving him, even though the river didn't really have a choice. It's not an animate object, but that's what Hakar Satov means. You recognize you benefited from something. So Rav Yonasan Eibshitz suggests that you have to have respect for your older brother, or your older sibling, any older sibling, because if the sibling had damaged the rechem of the mother in birth, there wouldn't be any children after that. So therefore, you owe your existence to your older siblings who preserved the health of your mother so that you could be born, so you have to have respect for that. It's a very creative interpretation. So one of the nafkaminas of that interpretation is that you only have to respect a sibling from the mother. According to the Rambam, but it's about Bechor, you would think that you only have to respect a sibling from the father, the oldest brother from the father. According to the Ramban, that it's about what the parents want, and presumably it applies whether it's the father's side, the mother's side, or either side. And that's how the Rush and others assume. So if Eibshitz is saying something else, that it only applies to siblings from the same mother. So he suggests on this pasuk that is emphasizing that Binyamin was the brother of Yosef specifically because from the mother's side he was only the brother of Yosef, and therefore he only had to respect Yosef, he didn't have to respect the other 10 siblings. So that's a creative interpretation. Okay. In any event, the next pasta continues, V'avo b'nei Yisrael, l'shbora b'sol chabayim, ki haya harav be'eretz Canaan. So the sons of Israel come, and they are seeking to get food. So this phrasing of V'avo b'nei Yisrael, the Yerushalmi, Maseches Brachos, understands that this is the source for the idea of a minyan. That the pasuk says that V'nikdashti v'soch b'nei Yisrael, that God's name is sanctified, a davar shebekedusha happens within the context of 10 Jewish men. So how do you know it's 10 Jewish men? Because gezeirah shava b'nei Yisrael there, and b'nei Yisrael here. So that's one of the possible sources for finding 10. There are other sources. The Bavli has a drasha from the Meraglim, that the 10 Meraglim are the source for the 10 men needed for a minyan. So it's a question, what's the real marker? Is it this, or is it that, or is it a different source? Some prefer this source, because it's hard to believe that the Meraglim, the bad Meraglim, Davka, the 10 bad Meraglim, they should be the source for our idea of a minyan. Seems a little bit surprising, and they therefore would prefer a source like this, which is better than the Meraglim we've seen. So it could be that the idea of using the Meraglim as a source is that maybe that actually emphasizes what the minyan is supposed to accomplish. That, first of all, the idea that when you have a group, whether it's for good purposes or bad purposes, the group is much stronger than any individual. So the Meraglim kind of display that. But also, it could be that the notion of the group being able to transcend the deficiencies of any one individual. So specifically, we take people who are not so exemplary, at least in that episode, and use that as the source for a minyan. Maybe represents that the power of the tzibur transcends the character of the individuals involved. But in any event, there are those who felt that it's hard to believe the Meraglim could be the mucker, and they prefer this pasuk, and maybe that's the idea. So the next pasuk goes on to say, V'yosei fu ha-shalit al ha-aretz, hu ha-mashbir l'chol ha-ma-aretz, v'yavo achei Yosef, v'yishtach v'lo apayim ha-aretz. So Yosef, he is the governor, he's the ruler, and he is the one who sells food to people. Right? That's the big department store in Yerushalayim. It's called the Mashbir. Right? It provides the goods for the whole country. So too, that was Yosef. He was the original store, supermarket. He provides all the food for everyone. And the brothers come and they bow down to him. So here the pasuk is really identifying him in two roles. He's saying he's the Shalit and he's the Mashbir. The Chabetzelis HaSharon and the Torah, so he suggests that connecting those two ideas and then saying that the Yosef's brothers came to bow down to him in that context, that this is to parallel what we are taught in the beginning of last week's parsha, in the beginning of Vayeshev. So you have two different dreams that Yosef relates about the brothers bowing down to him. The first one about the sheaves, about the alumos, so that represents his role as the source of food. And the other one, the idea that they bowed down to him himself, that's about his role as king, his role as royalty. So here, the nevuah is coming true. So the pasuk tells us that the brothers come to him in both roles, that he is the provider of food, and he is the king. And in the context of both of those, they bowed down to him, so that was a real fulfillment of the dream. The Medrash Rabbah in Bamidbar has a comment here that he is the shalit. Why did he have this merit? Why did he have this honor that he should become the ruler? Because he didn't give in to Eshes Potiphar. And as the Sfarim emphasized, there's a discussion about this in the Sefer Ma'oros Yitzchak, that we know, we say, Ezehu Gibor HaKovesh Yisro. So one might think that the quality of a king, certainly in the world in general, so the impression is, who's a king? A king is a conqueror. A king is somebody who is able to beat up everyone else. He shows his strength by his pushing around all the other people. While we understand it differently, that the zchus of royalty comes from self-mastery. The fact that a person is able to control his desires, control his emotions, that's real gevura. And because Yosef was able to control himself with Eishes Potiphar, so it makes sense that he should be the ruler, and indeed that's the position that he takes. Hi.
Would that person say that it wasn't that Yaakov's face came and Yosef ran away because of that?
No, it's related. You know, that's a part of how you do it. You know, the fact that Yosef was able to draw inspiration from remembering Yaakov's image is what gives him the inspiration to overcome. That doesn't deprive him of credit for that. The fact that he was able to recognize what that message represents is itself an aspect of self-control. In general, just parenthetically, there's a lot of literature nowadays about how self-control works, and that it's a little bit of a delicate balance, because on the one hand, they portray self-control as a muscle, that the more you work it, the more strong it gets and the more powerful it is. On the other hand, it's also like a muscle in that it can get exhausted, that you have to carefully manage your environment so that you're not called to exercise your self-control too much. Like we find in general in Hashkafa, we don't advise that you expose yourself to misyonos. We don't recommend that you put yourself in a situation where it's too easy for you to stumble. And that seems to be the careful balance, that you need a little bit of both. You need an environment that's going to not put too much demands on your self-control, because it does get exhausted. And at the same time, practice does strengthen it. So you could say both, that he's a person of self-control, and he needed also to have circumstances that made that come to the forefront. So he was able to be inspired by his father's imagery, and that's what pushed him to get up and say, okay, I'm going to control myself, and I, as a son of Yaakov, I'm not going to degrade myself in this way. I remember who I am. And he steps up to the plate.
Well, I think in the Art School, I read it, I was interested in that. Some say that he actually went purposefully. Like, he went with the intention to do it. So then it's not really self-control.
Well, ultimately, we exercise self-control.
Right, but I'm saying in the beginning, like what you're saying, he actually put himself in a position where he would not be able to.
Which would have been a mistake, and he overcame it.
What I'm saying, if you had both of those together, had Yaakov's image not come, he would have been in exactly what you're not supposed to do.
Right, so then you need the Kadosh Baruch Hu to help you out also. You need a combination of both. You know, you need the circumstances that make it possible, and you need to have enough self-control that you can maximize that situation, and you can step up to the plate at the time of actual test. Okay, so also Rav Hirsch, the point that we alluded to before, so Rav Hirsch notes that the emphasis here in him being the Shalit and the Mashbir, both in the same pasuk, is to highlight how surprising that is, because one might think that if he is the ruler, so he shouldn't also be the Mashbir. This is a administrative duty he could have given to somebody else. So here he is put in such a high position, and yet he's also the one who deals directly with the needy people. This was a part of his careful sensitivity to the process, that he didn't just farm this out, that he made sure to be the one who was directly dealing with people. And also he made sure that people came themselves and didn't send their servants. Because if you sent a servant, so then there was no way to know how much food everyone was getting, because you could have many servants. So he had this policy that you had to come yourself, and you could only get a certain amount of food per person. And it's because of those two policies that the story unfolds the way it does. Right? It could have been that Yosef and his brothers would never have met. If Yosef had some functionary who was giving out the food, and the brothers could have sent servants to go get the food, so then the servants would have met the functionary, and there would be no confrontation here. So it's only because Yosef had these two policies that you had to come yourself to get the food, and Yosef himself was the one dealing with it. So Yosef ends up meeting them, and the pasuk here emphasizes that he's both the Shalit and the Mashbir, and that's what makes it possible for it to happen. Right?
Did he do that on purpose? Did he know that he was going to meet the brothers?
It doesn't seem like it. It seems like he did it on purpose because of its other benefits to the system, and it's part of the Hashgacha that that's how things unfolded, which is also one of the major themes here.
Well, the Mishnah said that there were like three things that he did, those two, and he also made sure that people like signed up at the gate.
Right, and that's also how he knew. You know, the whole discussion of why he was able to recognize them and they couldn't recognize him, as far as talk about that also, that they say that he grew a beard, so when they knew him as a kid, he didn't have a beard, now he had a beard, so that's why they couldn't recognize him. So how come he recognized them? Some of the brothers were close in age to him, so they also probably didn't have a beard when you last saw them, and now they had a beard. So if that makes such a difference, so how come they couldn't recognize him and he could recognize them? So they point out to a combination of factors, that first of all, there was 10 of them, so he didn't have to recognize all of them. He could recognize some of them and then figure out from context who the others were. And also the fact that they had submitted their names, so he was notified in advance that they're around, so he had more information to work with than they did. That was also...
You don't think that it sounded like from the introduction that he...
He's also orchestrating...
In order for, you know,
it could be. Okay, yeah, it could also be the point. Yeah, maybe so. Could be.
Just to prove Arya's point, Yusuf must have knew that, you know, where his brothers were from, that they were running out of food due to the drought.
And they'd ultimately show up.
He must have knew that, no.
Okay.
Because, you know, generally, you know, geographically, especially like if you're a ruler of the land, ruler of the food, you know, all right, this place is going to be running, this place is a drought, they're going to run low, so after, you know, keep in mind, keep them food, and have to keep them alive.
So they're going to end up there, right? Okay. Okay, makes sense. So here the next pasuk says, Vayar Yosef es echav v'yakirem, v'yisnaker aleihem, v'yadavar itom koshos, v'yomer aleihem, me'ayin basem, v'yomru me'eretz kanan, lishbor ochel. So here Yosef recognizes them, and they don't recognize him, as we just mentioned, and he didn't want them at this point to recognize him. So he emphasizes that. He makes himself sound different. He took efforts to conceal his identity further so that they shouldn't catch on. So Rav Hirsch has a comment here that it's interesting that here you have these two words in a row that seem to mean opposite things, and they really have essentially the same root as far as the word is concerned. It's v'yakirem, v'yisnaker. And he recognized them, and he made himself strange to them. So that's opposite. He recognized them, they didn't recognize him, and yet the word comes from the same root, he asserts with Hirsch. So he says it's not really as opposite as it sounds, because the idea of strange, visnaker, doesn't just mean foreign, it means distinct in its own way. So when you recognize someone, it means you set it aside from the pack, you make it distinct. So that's why the words share this root, that even though they come out meaning opposite things in this context, but they have essentially a common idea. And he continues along that theme over there. Also, as far as also a little bit of a comical imagery, that the Malbim comments here that he was suspicious of them. They opened themselves up to suspicion because he's ultimately going to accuse them of being spies. And he says to them, "Me'ayin basam, where'd you come from?" And what do they respond? "Ve'yomru me'eretz Kanan, lishbor ochel." Right, that we came from Eretz Kanan. That's the answer to the question, is to say where they came from. And then they add, "To get food." So it sounds a little bit like they're protesting too much, because clearly they're there to get food. Everyone's there to get food. So he didn't ask them, "Why are you here?" He said, "Where are you from?" So it's as if they're saying, "We're here from Kanan, but we're only getting food. We're certainly not spying at all." So that Davka makes them look suspicious, as if they are coming to spy. Again, it has a little bit of a comical sound to it. And that's a part of where the flow comes from here, that he says, "I don't believe you're here for that. I think you're here to spy." Okay. The Rav in his drashos comments also on this next pasuk, which we've already alluded to, Vayakir Yosef es echav v'hem lo hikiruhu. So the emphasis is that he recognized them and they didn't recognize him, but the Rav in his drashos focused on their lack of recognition as a whole, and the Rav understood it to mean that Yosef recognized the brothers and recognized that they had changed. The Rav in his drashos has these very evocative descriptions how Yehuda's steely gray eyes had turned to a soft blue, and how he knows all this. I think this is a part of the imagery that he's reading in the story, but he's saying that he saw that they had matured and that they weren't the same kind of mean older brothers who had sold him into slavery, and they hadn't yet recognized how they had changed, which again is consistent with this whole idea that in order for there to be a genuine reconciliation here, Yosef had to put them through a process where he would be able to fully have confidence in their maturity, and they would be able to see how they had changed. And that was all a part of what was going on here. So then the pasuk continues, "Vayizkor Yosef es hachalomos asher chalom lehem, v'yomer aleihem meraglim atem, Lirosas Ervos Aretz Basim. So Yosef remembered his dreams that he dreamt for them, and he said, changed his course, and he says to them, you know, I think you're spies, and you're here to see the embarrassment of the land. So that idea, this pasuk here in general, some of the Sfarim emphasize that the idea, Asher Chalom Lahem, that he dreamt for them, so to speak, that the idea is that, in general, Yosef saw his dreams as not just dreams. One could ask, you know, why is it that Yosef told them about the dreams? He got in such trouble because he told them about the dreams in the first place, and that's why they were jealous of him and hated him, and ultimately, look what happened. So one could say that it wasn't so wise of Yosef to tell them about the dreams. You know, why didn't he just keep it to himself? So the point was, there is a theme in general that Yosef saw these dreams as not just dreams. He saw these dreams as prophecies. He saw these dreams as a nevuah that he was obligated to relay to the people who were the subject of the dreams. So that idea, Asher Chalom Lohem, that these were not dreams for him, he dreamt for them. This was a message he had for them, this was necessary for them to understand. So he felt like he had to tell them. And that this is consistent with what the Ramban says. The Ramban is one of the many who discuss another big mystery here, not just why Yosef treats his brothers the way he did, but why does he treat his father the way that he did? Why all these years does he not send a letter home? Why does he not get the message to Yaakov that he's alive? So some of the Mefarshim emphasize that he didn't want to have to put him through the pain of knowing what the brothers had done, which would be a necessary part of the explanation. But the Ramban emphasizes that he felt that because of his dreams, they had to unfold Davka this way, that all the brothers with the father and Binyamin and Yaakov all had to come to Mitzrayim and bow down to him there. So therefore he had to let the story play out this way. There had to be ultimately the realization of this nevuah. So again, the idea seems to be that his dreams are not simply dreams, but they are prophecies that he had some achrayis to let them be conveyed and to let them develop. And that's what's going on here also.
Hi. The Stone Chumash says it in the name of the Grah, but you know how Stone Chumash just says Grah.
Yes, okay.
Do you happen to know, like, a source that says that he believed that it was prophecy and that he had to tell it over to the brothers or something? Like, I've heard the idea.
Right, so I'm saying that's what a number of Sfarim say, that they, you know, that this language, Lahem, is, you could probably find that Grah for you specifically. But he's not the only one who says it. That's what this idea of Lahem seems to represent. Rav Soloveitchik suggests also that, therefore, the beginning of this pasuk, which says, Vayizkor Yosef Esachalomos, doesn't mean he remembered in the sense that you may have thought, but rather it means in the sense of Zachar Soma Shabbos Lekadsho, that the mitzvah of remembering Shabbos also really is meant to convey not just remembering, but anticipating and looking to bring it about. And so to here, with his chalomos, he not just remembered that they existed, but he anticipated them. He was looking to bring them to their fruition, and that's also a part of what we see here. So we won't read the rest of the psukim inside, just to comment a little bit more on the whole structure here, and also perhaps the relationship to Hanukkah, which is a point that Bezalel Radinsky discusses in Mishkan Bezalel. So ultimately, and this is something that Rabbi Rosenzweig also talks about, that I think we mentioned this yesterday, so ultimately, after the death of Yaakov, so Yosef would go back to the bor of last week's parsha, and he'd make a bracha there, a bracha that a miracle happened for him, that he was rescued from the bor. So why exactly did he do that? Rabbi Rosenzweig discusses the possibility that this was one more way of trying to kind of hint to the brothers what they had done without saying it straight out. That you can imagine what kind of an awkward confrontation that must be. Right? That here they're all there by the board together, and Yosef says, hold on a second, I have to make a bracha about the miracle that I was saved from this definitely deadly place. And he's doing that together with the people who put him there. So you can imagine just how awkward that must be. So it's another step in perhaps bringing them into a recognition of what they had done without necessarily saying it straight out. But it also seems, just to add to that idea a little bit, that there is a theme here also of Hashgacha, that you find that throughout the rest of Sefer Bereishis, that after Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, that essentially saying, listen, whatever you guys had in mind, it's not your plan, it's God's plan. Right? That God had an intention here, and he was calling the shots, and you have to do your own tshuva for your own intentions. But ultimately, in terms of what happened, it's God who's in control. And the idea of Hanukkah as well is in very much that theme that we discussed yesterday, that the notion of the Pach HaShemen and the relationship of that nes to the Milchama is a way of emphasizing that the Milchama, which seems naturalistic, is not something that just happens by itself. It happens only because that's part of God's Hashgacha, and therefore the candles, the oil rather, which is overtly miraculous, is coupled with this victory in order to make this point. And the boar is also there representing that. And Rudinsky, in his sefer, he suggests that that's also a little bit of what he was putting the brothers through, that the brothers are put through this whole obstacle course, this whole game, and then ultimately afterwards they look back and they see, oh, there was a plan here, that Yosef had an intention in what he was doing. So they recognize that Kal v'chomer, Kadosh Baruch Hu has plans all the more so, and that even in the moment we're not able to see it, but we look back and we can figure out how exactly the situation is for our benefit. And that specifically in the times of darkness, there is light, that's one of the themes of Hanukkah, and that even though we've had other nisim like this throughout history, but it's specifically in that time of great darkness, in the time of Choshech Yavan, that the light of Ner Hanukkah comes in and dispels the darkness. And he suggests that that's the nature of the bracha that we say, Shasa Nisim Lavoseinu Bayamim Haheim Bazman Hazeh, that the juxtaposition is that in those days, like these days, just like we're in Galus now, we're in Galus then, there are days of darkness, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu does a nes specifically in that context, that we're able to recognize even in those moments God's presence. So Yosef essentially is conveying to the brothers that fact that there is a plan that we don't always recognize, and that this is something that we have to ultimately acknowledge regardless of our plans. It's interesting just to kind of parallel this to what we talked about the other day. We'll say something to connect this to both of the past 2 days this year, as Afro Synergy and Chazara. But in the end of the Sefer Bereishis, so Yosef says to the brothers that you shouldn't feel bad about what you did, because Atem Chashavtem Alei Ra, that you wanted to hurt me. Yeah, it's true, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chashav Alei Tov, that God had good intentions for me. God had good plans. So there is an Or HaChaim over there, that the Or HaChaim writes that, yeah, you shouldn't feel bad, that again, it's like a comical scene from the movies, that somebody tries to poison you, and he poisons one cup of wine, and then the wine gets switched. So instead of drinking the poison, so I just drank Diet Pepsi, so you don't have to feel bad. You tried to kill me, but Lamaisa didn't end up happening. So it's hard to understand that comment. You're saying that attempted murder is not such a big deal, that if you tried to kill someone, but circumstances were such that it didn't work, so then there's nothing to feel bad about. You don't have to do tshuva for that. Is that really the message? So there are those who want to connect this to what we said 2 days ago. If you remember, we mentioned the distinction between Ben Adam L'Makom and Ben Adam L'Chavero mitzvos, that when it comes to Ben Adam L'Makom, God can credit your intention and onus Rachmana Patre, but when it comes to Ben Adam L'Chavero, it's all about the result. So there are some who want to say that L'Kula, to explain here also, that it's all about the result, so since you didn't actually hurt me and things worked out okay, you don't have to worry about anything. So that's a very difficult shot, because presumably when it comes to Ben Adam L'Chavero, we actually have a greater chumrah on both sides. We have a greater chumrah on the side of the impact, because people are affected in the real world by what happens and they can't credit your intentions. But your intentions matter also even more, because since we're dealing with mashpatim as opposed to chukim, so we can actually understand the value system that's involved, and all the more so we have to try to connect to that. So it's a difficult interpretation there, but presumably Yosef is making the point that you did what you did, and you have to do tshuva for that, and we have to address that. But ultimately, you have to understand that you don't call the shots, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu has a plan here, And that's what's being conveyed through Hanukkah, through his experience at the Bor, through his revisiting of the Bor, through this whole interaction he has with the brothers, that, and it's also a source of comfort, that yes, we have achrayas for our own decisions, and we're going to have to give an accounting for that, but ultimately, the bad things that happen aren't really up to us, and the good things that happen aren't really up to us, that that's all in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. We can't really change how that comes out, but we still have our own internal responsibility for our choices in the matter, and it's that balance that he is suggesting. And we'll just add to this one point, the idea of the emphasis of Hashgacha. So we talked yesterday about the Hiddur of Neres Chanukah, and if you recall from yesterday, the conclusion that we came to is that according to all Rishonim, there is a unique mitzvah of Hiddur when it comes to Neres Chanukah. We saw two possibilities yesterday, whether it's a standard Hiddur that has a greater urgency attached to it, or is it that it's a completely different form of Hiddur. But either way, it seems that Hiddur is uniquely important when it comes to Ner Chanukah. So why is that? Why is that of all the mitzvot in the Torah, in this case mitzvot Drabbanan, that Chanukah has this particular urgency and this particular association with Hiddur? So there are some who point out that the Nes, the Pach HaShemen, is itself particularly Hiddur focused. So for example, the Achronim have a kasha, why do you need the whole Nes of the Pach HaShemen? And we could have just said, there is a principle in the Gemara that Tuma Hutra Bitzibur, that when the Tzibur needs something, and the only thing available is Tameh, you're allowed to use Tameh materials for the purposes of the Tzibur. So why didn't they just use a Tameh oil? Why did they need a whole miracle to last to have the tar oil last for 8 days? So some of the Forshim give an answer that's not really such a razzle-dazzle answer, and say that, you're right, they could have used the Tameh oil, but it's nicer to use the tar oil. So what does that mean, it's nicer? So apparently it means that it's more of a Hiddur, that the whole Nasir is really for the purpose of Hiddur. And you find that idea throughout. So for example, the Beis Halevi writes that they didn't really need the miracle of the Pach HaShemen because there's no minimum shear for wicks. You could have used a very, very thin wick and that would have made the oil last longer. And they could have stretched out the oil by using ultra-thin wicks. So we suggest that, yeah, that would have been possible, but it wouldn't have been behavior. It would have been a very weak flame that would not have been so impressive. And you find others, the Ravid, who says that actually they had other oil that was closer. It was less than an 8-day journey, but the 8-day journey was for the most Mahudar oil. So all of these pshatim seem to suggest that the whole nes of the Pach HaShemen is really because of the needs of Hiddur Mitzvah. And if that's the case, it could explain on some level why Hiddur Mitzvah is so part and parcel of the whole experience. But still, the question is why? Why do we have these nisim that are about Hiddur? What's the point? So we could suggest, and I think this is particularly important for us as students of Yeshiva University, so we could ask, you know, this whole clash that we had with Hellenism, with the Yavanim, but here we are, so we are university students, we still embrace all of the cultures of the world and all of the art and science and the wisdom that has come from all the different societies and all the different cultures that are out there. So what's the difference between us and the Yavanim and the Misyavnim? So the answer presumably is the question of where does God fit into the equation? Do you believe that all of this art and science and beauty exists without God, or do you believe that it's all a result of God's presence in the world, and it's all because He's watching over us? So one of the indications that God is watching is the whole notion of Hiddur. If you believe that the world is a machine and that there's no God watching over us, so then there's no concept of Hiddur Mitzvah. When you try to turn your car on, so you turn the key, so if the car works, the car goes on, if it doesn't, it doesn't, but there's no idea of turning the key behidr. Either it works or it doesn't work. That's how a machine is. That just works or doesn't. But the hiddur only makes sense if you believe that there's somebody paying attention. That it's not just a machine-like structure, but there's actually an intelligence watching over us. So the statement, you're going to do a mitzvah behiddur, is a way of saying that you don't think the world is just functioning like a machine, but you think God is watching, God's paying attention. And it's that awareness that really comes to define everything that is different about the Jews and the Yevanim and everything in between. So this is all very much the message of Hanukkah, and perhaps this is very much the theme that our parsha is emphasizing here as well, and it's one of the many parallel points that we find in these parashios in Vayeshev and in Miketz and the time of the year of Hanukkah. So you had a question?
Sorry, just, can you explain to that, what's the difference between, let's say, like Hanukkah and any other holiday? Let's say, like, why don't we Pesach, you know, purposely, like, do the, you know, the whole Agada, you know, the whole Seder right by the window. You know, I know at the end of...
So the Pirsum HaNes, since that is a good question. Why is the Pirsum different? That's a great question. It's a little bit out of our scope for the running out of time, but maybe save it for the Chanukah Chagiga. Maybe we'll try to talk about that a little bit over there. All right, so but in the interest of time, we will daven mincha now. I wish everyone a Freilich and Shabbos Chanukah. All of the many themes of the Parsha and of Chanukah and of Shabbos should come together to give you great enlightenment and insight, and Be'ez Hashem, we'll have a Chazon on Sunday, and then we'll continue on Monday.